when you hear somebody say socialized medicine, an example of socialized medicine would be VA. In true socialized medicine, all of the healthcare workers work for and are paid by the government. They're employees of the government. That's true socialized medicine.
Right. And so, the Veterans Administration, that's what happens. People go to VA hospitals. Yep. They go to VA doctors. They go to VA nurses. That would be socialized medicine.
But people are out misrepresenting. They're just saying that any government-sponsored health care program would be socialized medicine. Right. And that's it's a misrepresentation.
Well, for example, Medicare, there's a heavy government element, obviously, in Medicare.
Right.
But it's not socialized medicine. Because, as you know, if you're over 65, you know,
right.
You have Medicare, you go to private doctors and private hospitals, and they're reimbursed by the government. The other thing about Medicare that a lot of people don't know is it's voluntary. Now,
The
great, great majority of people over 65 choose it because it's cheap and it's good and it works. And, in fact, a recent poll showed that 94%, which is an amazing statistic, 94% of people that have Medicare like Medicare. Garland, I don't know of 94% of Americans that agree on anything.
Yeah. I mean, for $96 a month, you're getting health care coverage. You're not
basic coverage. Now, if you want more than you know, catastrophic care and so forth, you can pay more for it. But Medicare A, the very basic coverage, the one that takes care of you in emergencies and things like that, is your right. It's far cheaper than what I pay.
Yeah, well, what you basically get is you get Medicare A under 99.9% of all circumstances. Medicare A doesn't cost. There's a few instances where it could, but 99.9% of the time, Medicare A doesn't cost anything. B costs like $96.40 a month. The thing about Medicare is most of your things it pays 80-20. It pays like 80%. But as I was saying, the issue being is even that's not socialized medicine. It's single payer.
That's what Medicare is. Medicare is a single payer system for anyone over 65. It's voluntary. If you choose it, then the government pays, worries about all your health insurance needs and everything. And there's a copay, as you mentioned, and so forth. That's the plan. Mm-hmm. In other words, Medicare for all. And we'll have Congressman Conyers tell us whether there's a difference. But as I understand his bill, it's basically like Medicare for all. There may be a few distinctions here or there that he can tell us about. But it's this plan. And that 94% of Americans who have it like it extended to those of us under 65, which I think is a great idea, not only because, hey, I would love it. I would save a lot of money on my health care.
Right.
But also because it would help the Medicare system. A lot of people have been talking, Republicans talk about the fact that Medicare is going bankrupt.
Right.
And it's true that Medicare often doesn't get enough to pay for what's going out. But here's the dirty little secret of Medicare. If those of us under 65 are allowed to join, it would make Medicare a lot stronger because the average 40-year-old is more healthy than the average 65-year-old. That's just the nature of being human.
Right.
So those of us that are healthy paying into the system would bring more money into the system, less money going out. It would actually help the seniors, too, who are worried about Medicare, if those of us who are younger and healthier are allowed in.
Not to mention it saves us money. Now, instead of all this money coming out of your pocket or worrying about not having health care, most people can afford it. You could even do family plans and things like that. But whatever the case, these 20-year-olds, they're not going to be going to the doctors for much.
And here's the weird thing. Employers should like it, too.
Right.
Because employers, I just saw a statistic. Healthcare has doubled in the last 10 years. According to the National Business Roundtable, which ain't no liberal group. This is a conservative group that monitors business. They said that the costs are going to go up. They're going to more than double. They're going to go up double and two-thirds, 166%. In the next 10 years, until 20% of our entire economy is controlled, is spending on healthcare, if we do nothing.
And that's the other thing that a lot of people don't recognize, people who are opposing all these healthcare reform plans. They're just talking about, well, it's going to make all these bills for the future. The bills for the future are going to be much greater if we don't do healthcare reform. What's not being talked about all too often is that without what happens without healthcare reform, and that is quite simply, as you said, medical costs, healthcare costs skyrocket to the point where either one of two things happen.
Tricked us. Thought it was him, but it's not. We're looking out the window, waiting for.
But either one of two things happen. Either the system blows up, or you get to the point where a select few people can afford it.
Right. I mean, you have to look at each of the subgroups, right? And it seems to me, I've always been in favor of a single-payer system. After all, in Canada and Australia and New Zealand and England and France and Japan and really every industrialized nation on Earth.
And, of course, you know what Canada and Australia call their universal medical system? Medicare.
Well, that's exactly the name for it in Canada, in all those countries,
people live longer in the United States. They get better care than the United States, and they pay half of what we pay. So, you know, I don't know why people don't want better care at less price. I guess it's because, you know, if you're paid by the insurance companies, I get it. If you work for an insurance company and you get a part of their profits, I understand why you oppose any reform. But anybody else, I don't understand the opposition. And you just go through the groups. If you're talking about people over 65, their Medicare would be stronger because more young people would be paying into the system. If you're talking about people under 65, if you don't have health care right now, it's a great way if you're uninsured. If you do have health care right now, if it's paid for by your employer, then the employers, again, the same study, the National Business Roundtable, right now employers pay on average $10,000 per worker. In 10 years, it's going up to $25,000 a worker. That's got to come out of your paycheck. They got to pay for it somehow, or they're just going to drop your coverage, which is worse.
And you know what's even better about Medicare? A lot of people don't realize this. They have two programs, Slim B and QMB. QMB is qualified Medicare beneficiary. Here's the bottom line. Let's just say you're a senior and you need Medicare, which is $96 a month, but you're very poor. You're getting $500-$600 a month, some people. I've seen $435 a month. You know, sure. You're getting basically nothing a month to survive on. You're living in maybe some, you know, senior homes, and you're just barely scraping along making it. You don't have enough money to pay the $96.40 a month. You don't have to. Slim B will pay it for you. So the bottom line is, it's already the perfect system. If you're over 65 and you cannot afford Medicare, what happens is you simply fill out the forms and it's all covered. It's all paid
for you. Medicaid if you're poor and under 65. Right. There's disability. The system works, and it works in every country on earth except ours.
And we wouldn't need Medicaid anymore. You wouldn't need medical assistance in reality anymore because Medicare would cover everyone.
Right. That's right. So the irony of all of this is that if you're paying it for it yourself, it's better. If your employer's paying, it's better. If you don't have it, it's better. If you're over 65, it's better. And yet, President Obama doesn't, even though he supports single payer and he's on record as supporting single payer, he doesn't think he has the votes for it because the Republicans, they're the just say no party.
Right.
They're going to say no no matter what happens. You could give them, you know, everything they want on a silver platter. And
which is incidentally, is what I believe happened.
Well, pretty much. The only Republican who I think actually is fairly trying to find a solution is Olympia Snowe of Maine. I'll give her credit.
Right.
She's the one senator who I think actually is trying to find a solution. All the other Republican senators, they're on the no pile.
Well, you know, you got to. And once again, you're listening to 89.3 WPFW. My name's Garland Nixon. Tonight, Mark Levine and I are here, and we are awaiting a contact from Congressman John Conyers. You know, incidentally, my daughter, I said, hey, we're going to have John Conyers. She said, oh, wow, the guy from Terminator. I said, no, that's John Connors.
Oh, I didn't even know his name,
Garland. Fictional character. But
well, I know John Conyers pretty well.
Shows you how much my daughter knows about politics.
I used to have the distinct honor of sitting behind John Conyers when he was the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee at that time, the top Democrat, but the Republicans ran the House at that time. And so I've worked with the man a long time, and I got a lot of respect for him. I'll tell you, and we couldn't think of a better chairman, frankly.
Yeah, my daughter's in her third year of college. I thought, I need to talk to some of your professors. But at any rate, you know, the big issue when we talk about the Republican Party and what's going on is this. There's a bigger issue here. Sadly, anything that could work out in a positive fashion for the American people, they must oppose. Anything.
Well, because they know that politically, Rush Limbaugh, their leader, said it best. He wants Obama to fail. He wants this country to go down the tubes because if President Obama succeeds, it will show America that, yes, a liberal agenda does work, as it worked under Franklin Roosevelt, as it worked under Lyndon Johnson. They don't want him to succeed. Right. They want America to fail. Like, for example, they really wanted the economy to tank.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they wanted to say that the stimulus package didn't work, and lo and behold, the economy is coming back, and now they don't know what to do, so they're concentrating on the health care. Their goal is to stop in its tracks. Making it cheaper for Americans to get health care because, let's face it, the insurance companies give a lot of money to the Republican Party.
So
pharmaceutical companies give a lot of money to the Republican Party.
What we've got to look forward to is anything positive that could work out well for the American people, the Republican Party has to fight it. The president came in here with a strong strong support of the American people and a complete mess that they were responsible for. Any way we come out of that mess in any way, shape, or form – people will certainly, they know what everyone's going to look at it. And furthermore, they know if people start getting, with no health insurance, even in the Deep South, get a letter and a little card that says, you now have health insurance, they ain't going to give it up.
Just to be clear, when you say they, you're referring to the Republican Party.
Yes.
One of the things I find fascinating, all the people that, I don't want socialized health care and the government can't do anything right. A lot of the people complaining enjoy all kinds of government benefits. Many of the people complaining are on Social Security.
Right.
Many of the people complaining are on Medicare. Many of the people complaining have done well from rural electrification and interstate highways and all the many things that the government has done. And what, like, for example, you find people, in, as you say, in the Deep South saying, don't touch my Medicare. I don't want government-run health care. Well, hello, that is government-run health care. So it's an amazing thing. It's like the government's really helping me out a lot. The government screws everything up. It's this idea that I don't know whether they're just ignorant. I think they probably are. Mm-hmm. Or they're just being manipulated. But it's probably some of both.
Well, you know, it all started, this whole thing, not completely, but Ronald Reagan kind of started the ball rolling with, you know, the government's not the solution, the government's the problem. And that was rhetoric that seemed to work at the time. And then it went on with all the deregulation and things of that nature. And it was very popular. What I find very odd is all throughout the Clinton administration, the right was against the government, anti-government. They're going to take care of, they're going to do everything bad. You know, we are anti-government. That was the right's position. Then suddenly, when George Bush got elected, if you didn't go
got selected. Thank you.
Right. By the Supreme Court. Once he took office.
Right.
Please forgive me for that error.
That's okay.
Once George Bush took office, suddenly, if you didn't agree with them, you were with the terrorist. You went from being anti-government to, if you don't agree with the federal government, particularly the executive branch, then you're with the terrorist. And I might add, Dick Cheney said, deficits don't matter. No problem. Spend whatever you want. It doesn't matter. And then oddly, overnight, one election, and they became the party of fiscal responsibility. And we're supposed to believe that this is a credible argument. We're not supposed to assume that were they to get back in power, that they wouldn't suddenly have a problem with spending money. Well, of course, if you're killing people, you know, there's no limit on the amount of money they have to spend.
I do find this. I was just going to mention the same thing before you mentioned it first. But under Bill Clinton, the Republicans were deficit hawks. And they said, we need to end the deficits. And Bill Clinton did an amazing thing. He brought us to the biggest surplus in American history. $200 billion surplus by the time he left office from a massive deficit. And, of course, then they couldn't find anything to complain about. So they found Monica Lewinsky. Right. But then George Bush comes to power and gives us the greatest deficits ever by basically taking the money and giving huge tax cuts to the wealthy. And at that point, they said, no, we need deficits. Deficits are good. And now, of course, President Obama has inherited a $1 trillion deficit from George Bush. Right. And now they say, deficits are bad again. Let's stop this nonsense. Republicans don't give a damn about deficits. Maybe some voters do. But the politicians in power don't give a damn. What they're concerned about is they don't want money going to help people get health care or education. Or to help us, you know, get to a green environment instead of paying off of these oil companies. They want the money to go to oil companies and pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, defense contractors.
Right.
It's not about how much is spent. It's about where the money goes. That's always the battle in Washington.
Well, you know, I remember, I will never forget this leading up to the Iraq War, because it just struck me, because I made a statement after that on the air. Leading up to the Iraq War, one of the things the Bush administration did, they wanted to invade Iraq from the north, from Turkey. So they were striking up deals with Turkey. One of the deals they struck was to give them $36 billion alleged loan, really was a grant. There was no, you know, we'd pay us back sometime in the future thing. So they're going to give Turkey $36 billion, did. They gave them $36 billion just to allow our troops to start a war from their soil. Turkey gets the money.
They ever pissed back on?
Well, no. It was even more so than that. The prime minister or whatever it was took the money, went to the legislature, and they voted it down. They kept the $36 billion, and they didn't even allow that anyway,
which they should
get a medal for that. At that point, I remember saying on the air,
that's pretty clever, actually, on their part.
Yeah, I said, these people are spending money like it's Monopoly money.
Yeah.
That's the way the Bush administration, $36 billion, it doesn't matter. As long as you're not spending it. You know, if you think about it, this is the first, when can you remember a bill introduced you know, $1 trillion that was going to the working class, the working poor, and the poor.
Lyndon Johnson, the Great Society. Since then?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess Bill Clinton did some things, but not near in this, right. this scale. No, I mean, they're afraid that President Obama is going to be like President Johnson, like President Roosevelt, presidents that were overwhelmingly popular and did things. I mean, and again, I'm obviously Johnson in Vietnam was a huge mistake, but domestically, he did things.
I was going to say it wasn't a little,
it was a big mistake.
But we won't get into that. That's three whole shows.
Domestically, Lyndon Johnson, everything from civil rights to the Great Society, rural electrification, he actually helped the poor more than any president since Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
And helping the poor never seems to be a winning issue, certainly for Republicans. They oppose Medicare, they oppose Social Security, they oppose the Great Society, they opposed anything that could help working class people.
Right, because it always comes back to haunt them.
Well, it does, because when the working class people get stronger, they vote for the Democrats.
Right. Hopefully, as you already know, you're listening to 89.3 FM. My name's Garland Nixon. I'm here with Mark Levine. We're a few minutes into the show, but we are awaiting, and we are confident we will have Congressman John Conyers on tonight, and we'll have a little chat with him. We have the Congressional Black Caucus Annual Legislative Conference coming up here over the next few days, and that should be very, very interesting. I know they're going to have if you want to check it out, it's over at the Convention Center. They're going to have an exhibit hall with tons of exhibits, and there's going to be some companies doing, you know, free giveaways. Coke, they're giving away, you know, sodas and Pepsi and all the different companies giving away things. Many, many companies will be giving away small giveaways. There will be a lot of companies that are looking for that are taking resumes or giving out information on how to get jobs. Various government agencies will be there, also giving people opportunity for giving people the opportunity for employment. So if you're looking for employment, there will be a lot of places there that you may be interested in. You might want to go there and kind of wander around and talk to the various recruiters, because there will be actual recruiters there.
And I think we should let people know who Chairman John Conyers is and what the Judiciary Committee does, because I think a lot of people don't know that, and hopefully we're going to get him in very soon, and then there'll be a chance at the end for you folks to call in. So Chairman John Conyers is, of course, from Michigan. I believe from a Detroit suburb is what he represents, and he's been
part of Detroit. Well, I'm not going to think. Let's go.
We can ask him. You're right. Maybe actually part of the city of Detroit. In any case, he has been in Congress at least 25 years.
Since 1965.
Oh, you know. Okay, there we go. That's 34 years.
He was born
years.
In 29.
It's a very long time. And the way Congress works, frankly, is longevity matters.
Mm-hmm.
And if he is the longest-serving Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, and that makes him the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Actually, the way it works is if the Republicans were in control, they'd have the chairmanship, and he would be what was called the ranking member, which is what he was when I worked there. And if the Democrats are in control, which, of course, they are, they have a majority, he is the chairman. And the Judiciary Committee handles some of the most controversial issues in Congress. I mean, everything from abortion to gun control to civil rights to criminal law, that's all under the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee actually are even the ones that vote articles of impeachment, and they did so for Bill Clinton back in the 90s. So this is a very controversial committee, tends to have lots of liberals and lots of conservatives, and they don't agree on much of anything, I can tell you. I was there. But John Conyers, I'll tell you one thing he does really well. He's a good liberal. He's a good progressive. He certainly agrees with just
very
about
strong
any...
on the single payer option. I'll tell you
on that.
He's Mr. Single Payer.
Absolutely, but on a lot of things.
Yes.
He's strong liberal, strong progressive. But the thing that I think he does well is, as I think John Conyers has sort of a courtly manner.
Yeah.
So even when you have some of these Republicans who like to yell and scream and put up some pretty dramatic right-wing views, it never seems to faze John Conyers. He seems to take it very smoothly and respond, and sometimes even get a laugh. And I think sometimes that matters. It's not just that he's good on liberal and progressive issues, but he can handle even the worst disagreement and do so in a way without people really getting angry. And I've always respected that about him.
And that's tough in Congress because dealt with a lot of politicians throughout my career, one thing I find is that no matter who you are, no matter what side of the aisle, no matter how progressive you are, you're going to end up with people angry at you for one reason or another. You're going to end up with people, you know, people are going to say, hooray, you did this, 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 this. And then you're going to have people who are angry with you because you didn't do something that they wanted. So it's a very difficult position, particularly the Judiciary Committee, because there are always people that are going to want you to go further on something. And there are so many factors. One thing I think is important to keep in mind is this. The party as a whole has to maintain continuity. And when you look at the various committees, a lot of people, when they look at the various committees throughout Congress, they want various committees to act independently. They want committees to kind of be, I'm not going to use the word rogue, but they want the chairs of committees to take action independent of the party and independent of what other people in the party want. You know, the reality is this, the party maintains continuity. And if you're just because you're the chairman of the committee doesn't mean you can completely go against everything the party wants on everything there. The party has to maintain continuity.
The chairman
party will
has
go
a
down.
Boss. It's the Speaker of the House. It's right. Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
And usually the speakers give chairmen a decent amount of leeway. But there are times when they get rolled. I remember back when Senator Patrick Leahy was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. and Tom Daschle was majority leader, and this was right after September 11th, and they proposed what was going to become the Patriot Act. I was there at the time. I actually worked on it, and John Conyers did a terrific job, worked with the Republican, Jim Sensenbrenner, came up with a terrific compromise that protected civil liberties mm-hmm. and at the same time gave us the tools to fight terrorists. In any case, in the Senate, the Republicans and George Bush was saying, if we have another terrorist attack, it'll be the Democrats' fault. And Senator Leahy was trying to do the same thing that John Conyers had done in the House. Take his time, get it right, work out the best thing. And he worked on it for about 3 weeks, which actually is not a lot of time legislatively. And Daschle was being threatened, basically saying it's Tom Daschle's fault if there's another terrorist attack. And he had an election coming up.
Right.
So Tom Daschle actually rolled Leahy. And this is where the majority leader of the Senate actually rolled over a chairmanship and said to Leahy, I'm sorry, I'm taking this away from you. Mm-hmm. And he allowed the Republicans to do whatever they wanted, and that's what became the Patriot Act. So the chairman, by default, normally have control, but the leader of the party in the Senate or the House can take that authority away if in a very serious situation. Obviously, I wish Daschle hadn't done that, but I understand why. He's in South Dakota. It's a very red state, and he was worried about re-election.
Look what happened.
At the end of the day, he lost anyway. So, yeah.
Right. And so now we're in a difficult...
Should we take callers while we're waiting for
John? Why
don't
we do that? If you want to be a part of dialogue with Garland Nixon and Mark Levine here while we wait. We're waiting patiently for Congressman Conyers, 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. If you want to call in and basically talk about any of the things that we talked about, discuss some of the things, and just basically be a part of it. We've kind of got a little bit of open time here. So
we were going to have John Conyers first and then callers, but we may have to do this in reverse order here.
So if you got something you kind of want to talk about, particularly the things that we've been discussing, feel free to call and become a part of dialogue. Once again, 202-588-0893. Another issue that I think is that we need to think about, and I don't want to get away from health care. I don't want to get ahead of us. But that is that once we pass this, one thing I think the party has clearly, hopefully learned, and that is that when they move on, because President Obama is not one to move slowly in small incremental steps, as we've seen. We're looking at energy bills. We're looking at education. We're going to be looking at some...
And there's still, frankly, a lot in his agenda that I'd like to say that he is holding back on. I mean, he's got like 50 things he wants to do.
And none of them are small.
And he's doing about five or six big ones. But, there are other
things. There's huge things.
Frankly,
and I think,
one
thing that's important to see now, and that is the Republican Party is the party of we're against everything. We want you to fail. So I think the Democratic Party is going to have to look forward going into these next, whatever the next large bills they're going into, are going to have to look forward and think about how they're going to address this issue, because it appears it's to the point now that the party's going to have to just kind of shove through whatever they can shove through, because it doesn't look like they're getting a Republican vote on anything for the next three and a half years.
You know, when President Obama ran for office, he ran as, by the way, the same way George W. Bush ran for office. He's saying, I can reach across the aisle, I can work with both sides. And it's fun. The American people love to hear that. And every politician comes and says it. And I have no doubt that Obama was sincere in saying he wanted to reach across the aisle.
Well, he's tried so hard his own party's gotten mad at him.
Well, that's exactly right. And Bill Clinton did too. But at the end of the day, I remember saying on the air at that time, President Obama, you know, God bless him, doesn't realize how entrenched the Republicans are. They will not work with him no matter what he does. And I said it a year ago, and I think President Obama has learned a bit of a hard lesson, which is that the Republican Party does not want him to succeed. Their leader, Rush Limbaugh, made it very clear, right, no matter what he does, there's no one to reach across to. Olympia Snow may be the sole exception.
Right.
There's no one else he can reach to. And now I think he's learning that the only way to get what he wants done is to rely solely on Democrats, maybe in Olympia Snow, mm-hmm. and if that means that he has to use a special procedure called reconciliation for 50 votes in the Senate instead of 60 votes, then that's what he's going to have to do. The Republicans are just not going to play ball.
Well, you know, I don't know. I would suspect he's a pretty astute politician, and he figured it out pretty much when we figured it out.
Yeah,
you know,
well, maybe it was just a campaign tactic. I don't know.
What I think is this. I think that President Obama, in my opinion, is one to say, I'm going to continue to say, we're working for bipartisanship. We're working for bipartisanship. We're working for bipartisanship. All the way up to the edge where it gets to the point where now votes have to, things have to happen. And he's going to say, I worked for bipartisanship so long my party, you know, my own party got mad. People turned on me. I couldn't have worked any longer or tried any harder. Now that we don't have it, I'm going to do what I have
and
to do.
That may have been his strategy all along. Maybe the strategy is to convince the American people, to show them he tried.
And
to show them that he tried. And for the American people who didn't realize last year the Republican Party was a party of no, at this point I think Democrats get it. Even most independents and some Republicans get it. All the Republicans want is the status quo.
And doesn't it demonstrate it even more? I mean, it makes it more obvious when he continues to do this up to the last second.
Right,
it makes it more obvious what they're doing. We've got 2 minutes here. Let's go to Asim. How about that? We've got a caller. Are we there, Asim?
Asim, you're on the line. I hear silence.
Yes.
Yes. Hello.
Oh, there we go. Yes. Hi. Welcome to WPFW. We've got two minutes before we go to our we go to break. What's happening?
All right. Quick. You're talking about Rush Limbaugh. I could have Rush Bimbo, but that's a different different subject. When it comes down to Republicans or Democrat, I voted Democrat all my life, and I'm a hardcore Democrat. But the more and more I look at it, the problem is Democrat politicians, all politicians, they might come in with good intention. But once they get into the office, I think the main issue is lobbying. We always tend to forget about those, and they're the one who actually do a lot of control of the politics that was going on there. And once we stop lobbying and the legalized bribery that's going on in Congress, we cannot do something good for the good sake of this country or the American people.
I couldn't agree more.
That's in my own opinion, I think as legislation can be pulled.
I couldn't agree more. Sam, I think you hit the nail on the head.
Absolutely.
I mean, it is legalized bribery, and the sad thing is not that it's bribery. The sad thing is that it's legal.
Right.
I mean, you're always going to have people trying to influence politicians.
And that's the issue I'm having with how are we going to do good laws and pass, you know, good laws for the American people as long as there is, you know, those legalized bribery.
Yeah.
That's where we should start. Before we get into all that, we should stop all of that. Then we can have a good, honest discussion of Congress. Until we do that, there's no way we can have. I think we're going to get some type of just going through the motion. We are going through the motion. We yell a bit, Republicans, Democrats, this and that. At the end of the day, who get the biggest bucks, they do whatever they want to do.
I'll tell you, I think 60% of all of America's problems could be solved if we just had public financing of campaigns the way they do in Europe and Australia and everyone else. You know, Americans, some Americans say, I don't want to pay taxes for clean government. Let me tell you, that's the best tax money spent. It's very little money, but that is money well spent if the public controls the financing of political campaigns and not the lobbyists.
Okay, we want to thank you for calling. We've got another caller standing by. However, at this time, we're about to go to a PSA.
Here is a statement from local station board candidate, Dawn Johnson.
My name is Dawn Johnson, and I am a longtime listener and renewing member of the WPFW family. I am sincerely excited about the opportunity to serve as a member of the local station board of directors, and I'm seeking your vote. Over 18 years of community service has provided me with a patient and listening temperament, a heart for the underrepresented, and the skills to locate, develop, and utilize resources to improve conditions and to meet the needs of supporters and the community as a whole. WPFW has a very special place in my heart as I recognize the importance of community radio to its listening audience, oftentimes being the only place to find news that reflects a special interest and celebrates the culture of its diverse members and listeners. No other station in the Washington metropolitan area offers jazz and justice like WPFW. It is a broadcast jewel to those that know it and support it, and I wish to be a part of the leadership team that helps maintain its success and grow its capabilities. Peace and blessings.
And that was a statement from local station board candidate Dawn Johnson. Your ballots have been mailed out. Remember, mail the ballots in by October 15th. If you have not received your ballot by September 28th, call 202-588-0999, extension 308. Thank you.
You can do it. You can do it. We know you can. You can do it. You can do it. We know you can.
Whereas it is important for the youth of America to recognize and understand jazz as a significant part of their cultural and intellectual heritage.
This year's 25th annual Congressional Black Caucus Jazz Issues Forum theme is the First Lady's Jazz Initiative, Taking It to the Grassroots, and we'll explore how to extend jazz education opportunities to culturally underserved communities. Panelists will include Dr. Larry Ridley, representing the African American Jazz Caucus, Wayne Brown of the National Endowment of the Arts, and Warren Shad, CEO of Shad Pianos Incorporated. WPFW's Willa Jenkins will serve as the forum's moderator in a one-hour discussion to be held at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, located at 801 Mount Vernon Place, Northwest Washington, D.C., and will be broadcast live on WPFW beginning at 7:30 p.m. The forum will be followed at 8:30 p.m. by the annual jazz concert, which will feature the Louis Satchmo Armstrong Summer Jazz Camp Alumni All-Stars. Again, that's this Thursday beginning at 7:30 p.m. on WPFW at 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice radio, serving the collective needs and imagination of the community.
We can do it! We can do it! We know we can!
Can we do it?
Yes, we can.
Good evening, and you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. Garland Nixon here with Mark Levine, and our special guest has arrived, Congressman John Conyers. Good evening, sir, and how are you?
Greetings and salutations.
We are very glad to have you here. We've been promising you all half hour, so it's good that we can make good on our promise. Let's see which microphone to give him here.
The mics are on.
Okay.
All right. So we had we talked about a lot of things while we went all over the place while we were waiting for you. But one of the important things we talked about was 676 was your bill, and you know I'm sure a lot of people, a lot of our listeners are kind of curious about it. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about it.
Sure, it's a bill that provides everybody with all the health care they need, unconnected to an employer, and without regard to your employment status or anything else. It's universal, single payer, meaning there's only one insurance provider, and that's the government or a combination of private insurance companies all working together. but the whole idea that it's one.
Chairman Conyers, would this be kind of like Medicare for All? Would it be?
Exactly. That's where Medicare for All came from. Where they're interchangeable terms.
Yeah, that's something we discussed earlier. It's such a great option. Is there any way are there any things in here maybe that could improve the other bill, 3200? Is there any kind of correlations there or any things that could come together with those bills?
Well, yes. Now, 3200 is a blend of three committees in the House that have got to come to one bill. But the one thing without which we can't work on, and we can't reach any cooperation, is if, in fact, there is no strong public option.
Mm-hmm.
What is a public option? A public option is the opportunity for a person needing insurance to have the option of choosing a non-private insurance company, which they all are now, and they would get instead a public option, which would be a government insurance company, which would probably be better and cheaper all at the same time, since they don't have to advertise administrative costs and all the things that a business would have to do.
Now, to be clear, your bill goes farther than H.R. 3200. It goes farther than a public option. It makes public the option.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, the difference between H.R. 3200 and H.R. 676, the Universal Single Payer Health Care Bill, is that there is no... I just described the 676.
Right, right.
The 3200 is some improvements in the private sector, in the private insurance company, and we add the public sector, which would be the public option, which would be a strong measure like Medicare for All would be ideal, but that it would be a public insurance policy in case you didn't want the all the funny business that goes with a private insurance, which is your premiums can go up, your benefits can go down, your co-pays can go up, you can be disenrolled, as they kindly phrase it, at the option of the insurance company. You can lose benefits that you thought you had. And we've been through all of that for the last three or four generations.
Right.
Roosevelt talked about this. Truman talked about it. Kennedy talked about it. Everybody's talked about it. And now we have a bill in which I am proud to say I have 85 other members of Congress that are saying, yes, let's do that. Now, here's the political difficulty. I've already conceded that we may not get a single-payer bill. So when the administration and the others around the H.R. 3200 talk about, well, also, you may or may not get a public option, I say, here, take my cards. Take my chair, and let somebody else play this hand.
Well, Chairman Conyers, you know that there are a number of Republicans, probably virtually every Republican, has said they won't vote for a bill if there is a public option.
Right. That's
They're not voting for a bill if there is
if
or
a bill.
Isn't one.
Right. You know, and one of the things that a lot of people wonder about is this. There's that element, namely the entire Republican Party in Congress, who doesn't want anything. Basically, it appears to me, they don't want anything positive to happen under the Obama administration because everything was bad under theirs, and anything that positive that happens looks very bad on them. If you've got people that are all saying no, why not put what you want in there anyway? Because ultimately you're going to get the same thing, and a lot of people ask that question.
Can you get enough votes on single payer to actually have, from Democratic votes alone, because we know the Republicans won't?
No. I only have 86.
That's all.
You need 218. But now, that's why I'm saying that I would consider, I would vote for a H.R. 3200 that had a strong public option.
What if there's no public option? What if the Baucus bill or one of those bills comes out of the Senate? Would you vote against the bill?
What other alternative is it? I could vote present, I guess. Well, of course I'd vote against it.
And here's the big question that a lot of people need to hear, and that is, let's just say that we went along, that things didn't work out, and the Republican Party got what they wanted, and there was no health care reform, nothing. We just went on like we are now. Ultimately, where would that lead this country? Ultimately, what would happen as a result?
Well, things would keep going in the same direction that they've been going. Namely, more and more people would be uninsured. Premiums would continue to go up. Options would diminish. All the things that are happening now would continue to happen. But the organization and support for H.R. 676 would increase because you don't have anything left. And you put your finger on the key to the understanding the political negotiations going on. The Republicans are voting against Obama. They're not voting against a health care bill.
Right.
If you gave them these eight pieces of paper that would be blank and say, here, write a health care bill and bring it back to us in the morning, and let's see what we can do. They would say, no, we're going to vote no, because if anything Obama approves, they are against. And Obama said already repeatedly that anybody that wants to negotiate, the doors are open, the bar is open, the White House is open, right. I'll meet you anywhere, place or time. But if you're just here to destroy the consensus that we're trying to build around a better health care system through reforming, and you're not interested in that, then there's nothing to negotiate.
So what do you predict will happen? Are the Democrats in the Senate going to have to use reconciliation to get this through?
Well, of course.
50 votes. And one of the things I didn't understand is what would be the difference in a bill, because I know you can only do some things with reconciliation that you can't do. If they had to use 50 votes in the Senate rather than 60, how would it limit the bill?
It wouldn't.
It wouldn't at all.
Reconciliation does with the fact that you can't have a filibuster, which would take 60 votes to cut off. A simple majority in the Senate would carry the day.
And you wouldn't lose anything in the substance of the bill to do it
that
way?
Not one little thing, not a comma.
Another thing that I've heard discussed is the possibility of a bill coming out of the House with a public option and one coming out of the Senate without, and, you know, the what happens under those circumstances? A lot of people don't understand what happens if you have two different bills and then you have to get together.
You have a conference. Yeah, it goes to conference. And I'll tell you what will happen to a public option when it goes to conference.
You see, right. He just put his finger down like it's going to lose. Now, why would that be? I don't understand that. You have a majority of members of the House and a vast majority of Democrats support a public option. They voted for an H.R. 3200. The great majority of Democrats in the Senate support a public option. Don't they have 50 votes? Not 60, but 50 votes for a public option in the Senate? Why would the conference committee vote it down? I don't get it politically.
Because when you close the doors and put out the lights, things come in and things go out in a very mysterious, unexplainable way. So don't feel bad that you don't get it.
You don't think there's 50 votes in the Senate for a public option? 50
no.
out of the 59 living Democratic senators?
If I could name them, I'd write them down and say yes and give them you the list.
I'll listen to any names you want to mention on the air. So will our listeners.
Yeah. The only thing is, I don't know if they would stick with a public option.
Right. Yeah.
I'd have to get their signature first. But look.
Well, it sounds to me like what you're predicting, Chairman Conyers, is that the Senate will vote out not a public option. The House, of course, has already voted a public option. They'll come to conference. You've predicted a very bad result, which is no public option. And then you and probably your 85 friends won't vote for it. Sounds to me like you're not optimistic we're going to get a bill.
Did I act like I was optimistic?
No, but I want to be clear what you're telling the listeners. You are pessimistic that we're going to achieve health care reform. Is that fair to say?
It is totally accurate.
But
bad news.
We're positive. We'll continue to hope for that.
I could put on a happy face and tell you I think that, you know, somehow or other we're going to get through this thing. But look, you take the math. 187 Republicans,
mm-hmm. in the
all
House.
Against in the House. Then you take on the other side 80-something progressives, most of whom are mad if there's not a strong public option. Then you take the Congressional Black Caucus, 42, who will be unhappy without a public option. Then you take the Hispanic Caucus, about 25. They won't go for this. Then you take the Asian Pacific Caucus, about 14 or 15. Look.
Well, I get it. Only a public option will pass the House. I get it. But my question is, why won't a public option pass the Senate under reconciliation? 50 votes. I understand we've got Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who's from Nebraska. He probably won't vote for it, but we can get 50, can't we?
Well,
along with the vice president, that's all we need.
Allow me to do this. Tomorrow I will start. I will take a sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper. I'll go 1 to 50.
And we don't
then
have
I'll
50.
Start putting their names down.
Well, they should put their names down. Shouldn't there be a public petition where we could start with the people we know support it in the Senate, and let's get their names on the record, supporting a public option?
Yeah, that's exactly what is being done. AFL-CIO, all the unions, nurses, the students, the American Medical Student Association, AMSA, the community. The most Americans want a single-payer option, according to the polls that we didn't conduct.
Well, there's one thing that I've always felt that isn't discussed. There's a premise in the press often that I don't know. I hope I'm not saying the wrong thing, but there's a premise in the press that I don't necessarily agree with. One of the things that are talked about is the blue dog Democrats, the Democrats that were in tough area, tough districts, that they have to be concerned whether or not they'll get reelected. It's reasonable, and that their vote will basically hinge on whether they'll be reelected, and that's a valid premise, that if a congressman or a senator looks at this bill and says, this is best for the American people, this is going to give the American people what they need, this is will change the health of lots of poor people, but I won't get reelected, so I'm going to vote against it. And I've always felt, when I hear that talked about in the news as though that's a valid premise, I always felt someone ought to say, wait a minute, if it's the right thing to do and you know this is the best thing for America, shouldn't you tell people before you get elected, well, you know, I'm going to do the best I can for the American people, unless, of course, you know, I might not get reelected, then I won't. And this the whole issue with the blue dog Democrats, that always kind of upset me that premise isn't at minimum challenged.
Well, it is challenged because it's not consistent on its face. Look, the blue dog Democrats are blue dog Democrats because about half the time, half of them vote Republican anyway. So that is an unacceptable premise because they don't, every time they vote a Republican, they're not saying, I think I'll get defeated. So that doesn't even hold water. Look, most of the people in the blue dog districts, they want a universal health care bill just like everybody else. They're not in any favored position. Matter of fact, many of them would benefit from it more than any other plan going.
Yeah, because a lot of poor people live in those districts often.
Exactly. And growing numbers of African Americans and other minorities, too.
Right. You know, I saw a statistic. I wish I could remember which one, but they were one of the Republicans who were, you know, forcefully fighting against the any type of health care reform. And the numbers were like 34% of the people in this person's district had, it was down south, a very poor area, did not have health care reform.
Well, I'd like to maybe.
I mean, did not have health care coverage.
Yeah, I'd like to then dispel a myth, because there, one of the fascinating things I found is that healthcare reform affects primarily, almost entirely, people under 65, because people over 65 get Medicare. And yet the polls I saw showed that young people overwhelmingly support healthcare reform, and the biggest skeptics were seniors who wouldn't be affected by it at all. So Congressman Conyers, I'd like to dispel the myth that somehow either your bill, 676, or H.R. 3200 would hurt Medicare in any way.
Well, you've done a pretty good job. You dispelled the Blue Dog premise of being defeated if you support the bill that would benefit their constituents more. And now we're going into the seniors, where there's been this huge propaganda thing that you're going to lose Medicare benefits if you go for single payer. Single payer is Medicare for all.
Right. So it doesn't, make any sense.
The other part I never understood was the whole death panel issue. Seniors, if we get, you know, quote, socialized.
Well,
here's the part about it. If we get this, quote, socialized medicine, if the government takes over our health care, then you're going to have death panels. The government already handles their health care.
That's right. They're not killing grandma now. Right. Why would they kill grandma?
It's like saying, if you get what you already have, then they're going to kill you.
So how do we dispel the myths? I mean, Garland and I are on the radio doing our best, but why do people believe these lies? I mean,
but can I put in a word for my favorite Republican emerging leader?
Sure. Rush Limbaugh?
Sarah Palin.
Well, she helped spread the lies. She's
the one who started off the panel discussion.
Right.
The death panel. Sarah Palin, first of all, is a good-looking gal.
So people believe her because she's so pretty.
No, they just like good-looking gals. Had nothing to do with her mental capacity.
We need to get a nice model to run for.
Okay, now, but the other thing is she's exciting. She's lively. She peps up a crowd. That's why McCain picked her. To his disgust subsequently.
But isn't this insulting? I mean, are Americans, I'm sorry to say, are they really that stupid that they're just going to believe a pretty face rather than the facts?
Well, look, there are two people that tell untruth. People with pretty faces and then the rest of people. So, but the reason I like Sarah Palin is that she ensures us of the continuing destruction of the Republican Party
know
it.
I support her for Republican nominee. Well, I think Obama can win 46, 47 states if she wins the nomination.
This is just between you and me and your listeners.
Well, there's only one or two. So
the whole idea is that we should let Sarah Palin. She's already quit her job as governor.
All right.
She's got I think she's trying to write a book, or somebody's writing a book for her. And she wants to get into the action, and she wants to take over the leadership. Please, let's give her all the rope that we can.
I hope she succeeds very much.
I think one of the things that Sarah Palin represents is that the Republican Party is, you know, kind of filtered down. The Republican Party has been, as I call it, concentrated. That is, from my opinion, we've got a worse bunch than we actually had under the Bush administration, because over the past few political cycles, the moderates all got wiped out and replaced by Democrats.
Right.
So now all you've got left is the true believers, and I think Sarah Palin just kind of represents what the party has become.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now the thing is a three-way split between Newt Gingrich, who has reconstituted himself for the third or fourth time. It's the new Newt Gingrich. And then we have ex-Governor Sarah Palin. And then, do you remember McCain? He was supposed to be the titular head of the Republican
Party.
Yeah, they don't talk about him much anymore.
So between those three, I pick Miss Palin.
Yeah.
She's my personal favorite. I want to ask before we run out of time, though, Chairman Conyers, the Judiciary Committee obviously handles a lot of issues. Health care isn't even your primary jurisdiction there. What should we expect over the next year coming out of your committee? What things do you hope to accomplish between now and, let's say, next June?
Well, we're working on we had hearings today on the Patriot Act. There are three provisions that expire. And we had a hearing in the subcommittee of Chairman Nadler of New York, mm-hmm. Constitution Subcommittee. Well, I had the dubious responsibility of reminding people that before they pulled this midnight raid that I was inspired by somebody down on 1600 Pennsylvania there, without mentioning any names, since my investigation has been stymied pretty effectively. But there's a place there under the Bush administration where nutty ideas were guaranteed to come from. And the whole idea was that we had passed a Patriot Act that was reasonably concerned not only with fighting terrorism, but protecting our constitutional rights and our right to privacy.
I was there when that happened, and it was a unanimous vote, and everyone stood up and clapped. The only time I've ever seen that in the Judiciary Committee.
Exactly. It's the only time it's ever happened in the Judiciary Committee. And it took weeks and weeks to get there. Chairman Sensenbrenner, I praised him. I was the ranking member. And then we had a roll call vote, so that it wasn't just a voice vote where you say it was unanimous. This was everybody's got their name called. And so went to the Rules Committee.
Right. I was going to say, I don't think that Maxine Waters and Lamar Smith agreed on anything except that one thing from the far left to the far right. But go ahead.
So then you get to the bill goes to the Rules Committee to get the rules that will govern its debate on the floor. Well, the Rules Committee didn't meet till 2 a.m. And something happened to the bill that was voted out of Judiciary, which was replaced by another 300-page bill that no one had ever seen.
And that's the one that I pointed out that Daschle rolled Leahy to get that bill through the Senate. And Senator Feingold was the only person to vote against it, to his credit. So you want to revise these bad portions of the Patriot Act.
Well, actually, some of them actually expire?
Yes, the three that we're dealing with now expire. But one is the roving wiretap, mm-hmm. which is so outrageous it's never been used. So that gets us down to two. We think we should drop that. The other two are kind of over the top. The Inspector General of the FISA court has written that there were so many abuses that they agreed with the court, who also said there were so many abuses that we won't even allow this kind of thing to go on. And so we're in the process now of beginning the discussion of what to do with the three that expire.
Mm-hmm.
But there is the rest of the whole bill, which needs a lot of examination. So that's what we'll be working on.
Okay, there's just a couple minutes left. Besides the Patriot Act, what else do you hope to accomplish by next June? We get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Does that go through your committee?
It doesn't. But there are a number of other issues that have to do with trademarks, copyrights, and patents that we're all in the process of making real. Net neutrality is a big issue that comes before us. And the FCC now is agreeing with us that a person that controls some of the web space cannot favor you over you because they like you better.
Right.
It's got to be open to everybody. How
about, well, you know, I hate to, I hate to be the bearer of bad news
guys,
here.
Guys, one quick question. One last.
We've got
about
a minute left.
Are you going to end the cocaine crack sentencing disparity? You going to do that?
We had a very good. We've had very good hearings. Chairman Bobby Scott's done a brilliant job. But remember, the Supreme Court has been knocking all of that interference with judicial discretion for years. So there is a build-up to do something.
Well, I hate to, once again, hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but we've our hour's up. You've been listening to 89.3 FM, WPFW. My name's Garland Nixon. We've had Mark Levine. And tonight we have been fortunate to have with us the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, John Conyers. I'd like to thank you, Congressman Conyers, for taking your time out to come here to share your wisdom with WPFW.
Do you keep these tapes of the
discussion? We do.
We most certainly
well,
do.
Well, I'd like to come back after the vote and explain what happened.
We would be honored to have you.
Yes, I will talk to Cynthia and we will get it done.
We'd be honored and pleased to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.